You're listening to Inside Ouch. I'm Emma Tracy. Hello, welcome in. With me today, I've got Lana Grant, a mother of six kids who is on the autistic spectrum and the author of From Here to Maternity, about pregnancy and birth from her perspective. Hi, Lana.
Hi.
And another part of your job is raising awareness of autism as well, is that right?
Absolutely, yes.
So you do presentations and that kind of thing?
Yes, do lots of talks and presentations, focusing specifically on girls and females on the autistic spectrum.
Yeah, okay. So you have autism.
Yes.
How does it affect you?
I always say that actually the anxiety is the biggest disabler for me. Anxiety, which is very common in autistic people, male and female, it tends to be the thing that stops us from doing what we want to do, from being able to fulfill our potential, really. So my anxieties, I mean, because I wasn't diagnosed until I was 38.
Wow.
I had all sorts of diagnoses of anxiety, depression, postnatal depression, bipolar disorder, personality disorder, which was discounted. So lots of different diagnoses that I never felt fitted me. But the way that my autism presented before my diagnosis was very much in those meltdowns, the anxiety of not wanting to socialise with people, of not being able to go out to social functions. I found that really difficult, and I didn't understand why I found that difficult. So it kind of presented in that way. I struggled in jobs because I didn't always understand other people's approaches towards me, and found that really difficult, and would kind of spend a lot of time ruminating over that, I guess. I have a lot of sensory difficulties as well, or sensory problems.
So what kind of sensory problems, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Hypersensitivity to sound, so particularly very loud noises that I'm not in control of. Textures. I used to struggle a lot with labels in clothes when I was smaller, but obviously my parents didn't know what the problem was because they didn't know about autism then. So foods were very difficult as well. I was probably what you'd call a picky eater.
So you mentioned that you were diagnosed at 38, which is which is very late, I guess. How did that come about?
Because I'd had so many diagnoses of mental health problems, my upbringing was very straightforward. I had, you know, happy family life, but I found constantly that I struggled with going to school. Primary school wasn't too bad, but then it really hit home when I went up to secondary school, because I went to a girls' school and the girls that I was at school with changed. So they had matured, I guess, whereas I hadn't really matured.
And does that happen a lot with kids?
Yes.
With girls? With...
Yeah, we tend to see that tends to be why so many girls are diagnosed in adolescence. That's if they're lucky, obviously. Some of them aren't diagnosed until they're in adulthood. But lots of girls find that where they were in primary school, they were quite nurtured because they were quiet and compliant, and they were kind of mothered by the other girls. Then they move up to secondary and those other girls have matured, and of course they're finding their own way and their personalities, and that can cause problems because as an autistic girl you may not fit in to that, you may not fit into what they like, what they're into, and understand the subtleties of conversation, the sarcasm, all of those things that are going on. So I think adolescence and secondary school is a really tough call for autistic females and males.
And that involves puberty and everything as well.
Absolutely, which just magnifies, you know, the autism just magnifies the issues with puberty that neurotypical people go through. It just with us, it's just bigger, I think.
You've got quite a special interest in autism and puberty, don't you? And how people might be able to support.
The issue with puberty is that there are lots of sensory issues that come into play, particularly for females, which can be quite difficult. It's a change. You know, your body is changing, your mind is changing. And obviously, if you're autistic, we don't really like change. We don't want things growing on our body that weren't there before. We find that really difficult. The sensory issues around using deodorants, around periods, all of those kinds of things. And I just think that preparation for our young people is really, really important. And also understanding the complexities of relationships at the times of puberty, because many of our girls can become quite vulnerable at that time. You know, they hear the stories that are going around about what's happening with other relationships and things. I think that's that's true, and it's not necessarily true. Girls talk about what they've done with a boy, and for our girls, they listen to that and think, oh, okay, that's what everyone's doing then, so maybe I need to do that. And that obviously puts them in a really vulnerable position, especially then when you think that emotionally, very often autistic girls are slightly delayed emotionally.
And what do you find happens then?
Well, they end up in relationships that are maybe not the best for them. They end up maybe doing something and they might tell someone who they perceive to be a friend, then that friend, so-called friend, might then go on and tell somebody else. So then it's all around school, what's happened. And I mean, this happens for boys as well. You know, it's not just girls, it happens for boys as well. So there's that risk of exploitation. I think, you know, a lot of it is worse, obviously, with social media, mobile phones. You know, if a boy says, oh, send me a picture of you in your bra and pants, and a neurotypical girl might think, oh, gosh, no, I'm not going to do that. An autistic girl may not even think, they might think, oh, yeah, OK, I'll do that because then you'll like me. Yeah. And then, of course, it ends up around school and there are issues there, obviously.
So if the key to getting girls and boys with autism ready for puberty is preparation and talking about what will happen and how that might feel for you and how you might, what strategies you might be able to bring in to manage that for you. How do you help teenagers with autism around all the relationship stuff? Because preparation, does that work? How do we support them then?
I think preparation's important. I think the problem within education is that actually we focus very much on the physical technicalities. I call it the technical part of sex, you know, which bit goes where, that makes a baby, this happens. We don't focus enough on relationships with neurotypical children or with autistic children. But I think it's about being able to deliver a package to children where you're talking about those relationships. But I also think it's important to empower our girls to be able to say, that doesn't feel comfortable to me. I don't want to do that. So we can't change everybody else in the world. That's just not possible. But what we can do is we can empower our girls to say, actually, no, I don't. That's not right. That I don't want to do that.
Right. So focus on the emotional side of relationships in sex education classes.
I think so. And also, I think it's really important. I mean, when we have children that go into primary school, we give them a key worker because that supports them. And that key worker is almost like a translator to the neurotypical world. And I just think, even as an adult now, that you sometimes need that key worker. Not the same one, but, you know, a key worker through life, actually.
Right.
So you need someone who can bounce things off.
You need a neurotypical go-between.
Yeah, definitely.
Who kind of has one foot in each world.
And somebody that has your best interests at heart.
That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah, and can counsel and support and advise.
Yeah. Neurotypical is people without an autism
diagnosis. That's right,
So, you know, you talked about the key worker, and I suppose that leads me into getting pregnant in the first place. That's intriguing to me about how someone with autism kind of approaches that. Yeah. And then being pregnant and then becoming a mum. Tell me, what are the differences for women with autism in all those things, and how can they be supported better?
I think really that we have to go right back to basics. And first of all, we have to get clinicians understanding that women are autistic or girls are autistic, first of all, and how that autism may present, because we are still in a position where some clinicians feel that girls are not autistic. It's a boy's issue. Or if they do feel that girls are autistic, then they're maybe not knowing exactly what to look out for. So we need the diagnosis criteria, the diagnostic criteria, to be shaped up a little bit more and to be ready for girls. And then really, I mean, the issues around getting pregnant are not that much different, other than the sensory issues. And obviously, the Facebook group that I've got, you know, 220 today, I think it is.
Right.
We get new members daily. So 220 members who are all mothers.
With autism.
Or they're either diagnosed or they self-identify.
There's quite a lot of people identifying as autistic who haven't been diagnosed now.
Yes, and that usually tends to be after a child has been diagnosed. So they might have a child.
Yeah, because I asked you about your own diagnosis earlier, but we got sidetracked.
Yeah.
So it happens. And we, you know what? We actually had last week on the podcast, we had a woman with ADHD who was diagnosed as an adult once her, when her son was diagnosed. Is that what happened to you as well?
Yes, yeah. My son was diagnosed, and through that process, in some areas it's quite an in-depth process. So during that process, you have to reflect a lot on what they were like as a child, as a baby, etc., and read a little bit about autism. And then you kind of start to think, oh, okay, I was like that. Oh, I was like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of the bits fall into place and make sense to you. So, yes, I was diagnosed after my son was diagnosed,
yeah.
Which seems to be the same. A lot of mums are kind of pursuing that diagnosis for their child,
yeah.
And then recognise actually the same traits in themselves.
And was it, a lot of people say that being diagnosed with any impairment is a relief? Because it helps you to figure stuff out. Is that what happened to you?
Yeah, definitely. I often say that when I got my diagnosis, it changed my life. Because when you've spent the whole of your life feeling like you're a failure, because actually everyone else is getting on with things. Everyone else was going to school, going to college, getting their A-levels. And I actually just couldn't do that. So I thought, well, either I'm really stupid or there's something wrong with me. Why can't I do this thing called, you know, this thing that's life that everyone else appears to be able to do really successfully, or relatively successfully? Why can't I do that? So when you spend your whole life telling yourself you're stupid or you're rubbish, to have a diagnosis that says, actually, do you know what? You're not stupid. You're not rubbish, but you just think differently and you have a different way of communicating and seeing the world. That's a massive, massive relief.
Sure. So let's go back to the Facebook group. What's it called?
It's called Mums on the Spectrum.
Well, we talked about the making of the baby.
Yes.
So let's talk about pregnancy. So you and those mums, what are the things specifically to women with autism around pregnancy? And again, what would you say could be done better in terms of supporting?
The initial difficulties are usually sensory ones. I've spoken to quite a few women who are so hypersensitive to those changes in their bodies that sometimes they may be looked at as kind of erring on the side of hypochondria. It's a bit like puberty. You feel the change, you feel different, and that's difficult to handle, difficult to deal with. Having another person growing inside your body can be quite difficult.
So like kicking and moving. I mean, what did that feel like for you who's got sensory issues?
Yeah, it was. I found it quite painful, actually. I thought, you know, I'd go to the midwife and I'd say, oh, it really hurts. Oh, it hurts when the baby moves.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, I was looked at as if to say, well, yeah, and what do you want me to do? And I think if somebody had just said to me, well, do you know, actually, that's probably because you're quite hypersensitive. That's okay. It's all right to feel like that. Then maybe I wouldn't have felt, oh gosh, I'm just a failure and I can't do this pregnancy thing. I think the other thing that causes many, many women, myself included, a problem is that the minute you become pregnant, your body becomes public property.
Right.
You know, you have to go and engage with health professionals. Suddenly you become public property. People want to check your urine, they want to put blood pressure cuffs, which again I found really painful. And just thought that I was being a bit pathetic because, you know, it's a blood pressure cuff, but I'd be kind of cringing and thinking, oh, that really hurts. So there are all those things, and then, you know, you're opened up then to lots of people coming into your house. Sometimes I think the NHS is a massive institution in itself. It's a big machine, so you go in and what staff are delivering are what they do on a daily basis. But for those of us on the spectrum, we're not always sure what's happening and what's going on, and it's not explained particularly well.
Because it's quite tricky for a neurotypical person, actually.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's quite a, you see different people all the time.
Yes.
You might have to get an examination that you weren't expecting.
Yes.
And so for an autistic person, that's just magnified.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, you do, as you say, you see different people. So you don't have a consistent person, which is why I kind of advocate for birth partners to be empowered to speak on behalf of their partner. And if there isn't a family member, then again, it's about having that almost key worker system, that you've got someone you can trust that can advocate for you.
So you have 6 children.
I do.
Even though it was really painful when the baby moved. It was horrible having the blood pressure cup. Why? I mean, it's so rude to ask a woman. I've never asked a woman, why have you got so many children, Lana?
Yes,
you know, it's such a rude question. But it's interesting to ask why you went ahead and had 6 kids, even though it was all very, very stressful.
Traumatic.
Traumatic.
I think they were probably a special interest. I loved my babies. I love my children desperately. And I think I just loved the prospect of being a mum, of creating these new humans. And also, I just think sometimes I felt that I hadn't quite got the pregnancy thing right. I wasn't doing it correctly. So before my diagnosis, I thought, do you know what? Everybody else seems to do this pregnancy thing really well. But I get really anxious and really stressed. So maybe if I have another go at it, I'll get it right. And that sounds really silly to a lot of people. But actually, if you think about the autistic brain being, a lot of people on the autistic spectrum are perfectionists.
Yeah.
In my head, I kept thinking, I've got to have this textbook birth that I have read about and I've seen on the television, and I'm not having it. And actually, to be honest with you, I never did have it. So.
Right. But
there won't be seven children.
So the special interest thing, explain that. For people listening, what's a special interest in terms of autism?
A special interest, it's been called many things. Some people used to call it obsessions, which we don't like, because obsession points to something that can be quite harmful to the autistic person or someone else. So we talk about special interest now, and that is just something that an autistic person gets involved in, but they're really, really heavily and intensely involved in that, and it's something that they can do to calm them down, something that they can use as a reward system as well. You know, well, if I get through this meeting this afternoon, then if my special interest is trampolining, when I get home tonight, I'll trampoline for 20 minutes. And lots of autistic adults do use the trampoline and have all sorts of different special interests.
Do you have any special interests at the moment then?
Mine kind of range from listening to music. I used to have lots of constantly listening to music, usually the same song or the same album until I knew all the words. So I would say probably at the moment autism is my special interest and has been for a long time.
Yeah.
Because my whole life is autism based, really. So that's probably my special interest.
Which is useful, I guess.
It's very handy.
Or is it
no,
useful?
No, it is. It's very handy when you do it. You know, you live with other autistic people, so it is really handy.
But I was talking to someone recently who did an event for people with the same impairment as her. And after a while, she had to give up the event because it was the people around her were getting ill and she was getting ill, but she was pretending not to be ill so she could look after the people that she was doing the event for, and it all kind of fell over.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So is that a worry, or?
I think I've been through so many years and years of counselling and sessions about knowing that I have to put in protective barriers for myself. Mm. I didn't do it for a long time, and I did burn out. And after my diagnosis, I had mental health breaks, I had breakdowns where I struggled, but my husband's really supportive because he will say to me if he thinks it's getting too much for me and I'm getting ill, he'll kind of say, look, you know you maybe need to kind of calm down a little bit, but I've also put in my own protective factors as well. So if I do a talk and I'll stand in front of 150 people and speak for 2 hours, that will wipe me out for the next 2 days because of all of that social interaction, that stress, that having to be on show. And what I used to do before I was diagnosed, if something like that, because I mean, sometimes just going to work would wipe me out because of the social interaction. Mm. I would feel very guilty if I had an afternoon nap. I'd feel very guilty if, you know, I wasn't playing with my children because actually I was exhausted. Whereas now I don't beat myself up about that. I put those breaks in for myself.
And I mean, I guess that's the same for the Facebook group and managing that as well.
Yeah. I've got to say, you know, the Facebook group is something that I'm massively, massively proud of. And when I first started it, I thought, you know, well, there'll probably be about 12 people in it, the people that are my friends that usually come and listen to me at talks.
Yeah.
And then within 12 months, we've got over 200 people, and it's worked really well. But those women in that group are amazing. They're just fantastic. The support, the peer support that they give to each other is phenomenal, and it blows me away every time I look at the group, and I do look at it daily.
Tell me a bit about what the main things people talk about, because I'm in a big blind mums group, and I think a lot of the things are around carrying your baby on your front or your back. They're around sort of trying to spoon feed when you can't see, and then when they're older, trying to keep tabs on them, trying to help with homework.
I think initially there's a lot of stuff about the sensory sensitivities around breastfeeding. around giving birth, delivery, that kind of thing, about pain relief, how that's going to work. But a lot of the mums that are in the group are, not a lot, but a high percentage of them are past the kind of the baby toddler stage. Mm. What they're talking about now is having to go up to the school gates.
Right.
And to appear to be social with other school parents,
right,
because that's really hard. And anyone who's been a school mum will know that that can be really difficult, because people pair, you know, they kind of bunch off into groups.
Yeah, clique.
Yes, yeah. And if you find social interaction difficult, you don't quite know how to become involved in that group. So you might stand at the back. You don't know when it's appropriate to maybe interject or to speak about something. And I've kind of learned over the years that when people say, "Oh, hi, how are you?" all they want you to say is, "I'm fine, thanks, how are you?" They don't want you to say, "Oh, well, do you know what? I didn't sleep last night, and, you know, the dog's been sick today, and I'm a mess." And they don't want to know that. But as autistic women, very often we do overshare.
Right. So it's about counselling each other on how to just get through that school run.
Yeah.
Right. Lana Grant, thank you so much for joining me.
I've learned a lot. Thank you.
So Mums on the Spectrum is the Facebook group. Is it a closed group?
It's a closed group, but if you search it, you'll be able to find it. It's not a secret group. You can find it. Send a request. I do check you out and just make sure that, you know, you're who you say you are. Mm. And then, you know, you can enter the group.
And it's not just for women with a diagnosis, it's for women who identify as autistic.
Yeah, if it was just for women with a diagnosis, we probably wouldn't have over 200 members.
You've been listening to Inside Ouch. If you want to hear more of our stuff, go to bbc.co.uk/ouch. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at BBC Ouch, or you can email us your story, ouch@bbc.co.uk.